Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thanks for being here. My name's Roland Rudder. I'm the director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. Tonight, it's my great pleasure to be introducing our guest speaker, which is Mr. Alan Wolf. Mr. Wolf is currently a deputy director general at the World Trade Organization and will be talking to us on the topic of risks and opportunities for world trade. This is obviously a very opportune time to be talking about something like this with someone like Alan, and so we're very grateful to the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for bringing him out to Australia and for supporting tonight's event. As everyone is well aware, the rules-based global trading system is currently under a lot of pressure. The US and China are locked in a bruising trade war. Japan and South Korea have recently initiated their own trade battle. And the WTO dispute settlement system faces paralysis by the end of the year unless something can be done. Although it's easy to focus on these more immediate pressures, we also need to keep in mind that the deep structural challenges still remain facing the WTO, including a loss of legitimacy amid the backlash against globalization, the challenges posed by China's opaque party-state economic model, or what's become known as China Inc., and the dissonance between industrialized and developing countries that has long stymied negotiations in Geneva. Alan Wolf is well placed to shed light on these issues and what the future may hold for the WTO and world trade more generally. Mr. Wolf became WTO Deputy Director General in October 2017 after a long and distinguished career in international trade. He has served and advised both Republican and Democratic administrations in the US and served as Chief Trade Lawyer of the US Executive Branch, as Chairman of the National Foreign Trade Council, and as a senior US trade negotiator, as well as private law practitioner. Mr. Wolf will now address the audience, and then we'll also leave plenty of time at the end for questions from the floor. So with that, will you please join me in welcoming Alan Wolf to the lectern?
Well, it's a very great pleasure to be here, particularly because Australia is a leader in international trade and at the WTO in many ways. A splendid ambassador to the WTO, Francis Lisson, who, as you probably know, is heading up the effort to bring the WTO into this century. We lag a little bit. The rules of the trading system do tend to lag. She's leading the effort with respect to e-commerce, digital economy. Vitally important that that succeed. I wanted to cover several things. One is sort of the state of where we are today and where we might be headed. This is a time of climate change, but I'm not referring to the drought, which is not much in evidence during my visit to Sydney right now. The climate change is political. And it's a retreat, perhaps a loss of the spirit that animated the creation of the liberal trading order, the liberal world order, of which the multilateral trading system, and therefore the WTO, is an integral part. The liberal world order is under more stress than it's ever been since 1947, and the evidence is abundant. International agreements in general can no longer be relied upon to remain in place. Countries leave them. The United States has in several instances. Japan has. Japan and Korea have. Exchanges of salvos of increased tariffs between the two largest trading nations dominate the current news. The singular and remarkable characteristic of the WTO is that it provides enforceability of trade obligations. It is quite possible, it's in fact very likely, that in 3 months that degree of enforceability will be not in its current form. While international trade has been growing, the rate of growth is slowing and could soon enter a period of decline. For the global economy, the pendulum is poised between global economic integration and quite literally disintegration. By disintegration, I don't mean falling apart, I don't mean collapse, but a prospective unraveling. The movement towards global supply chains is losing momentum, and that's in part cause and in part effect of slower world economic growth. This is far from a cause of despair. Far from it. It's a call for increased efforts, which the world is quite capable of engaging in. A redoubling of effort to retain the multilateral trading system, which was painstakingly built over the course of 70 years, and to improve it. I do not take the threat of trade hostilities to the threat to WTO dispute settlement as by any means insurmountable challenges. They're not. In human history, conflicts are not forever. They come to a point of new equilibria, even if temporary. At some point, also, the exit door from international agreements will be considered less attractive, a path less taken. Pragmatism can overcome institutional challenges. None of the current series of damages to international trade is irreversible. Stability and progress can return. More worrying than the challenges just listed, to me, is the foundation of the multilateral trading system, which was non-discrimination. It is non-discrimination. It's the first article of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT. It's the rock upon which the WTO is founded. It has been crumbling for years. This is not a recent phenomenon. It's not something that came about because of an election in the United States or in any other country. All countries still pledge themselves to abide by the first article of the GATT, anachronistically known as most favored nation, because it certainly is not most favored nation, treatment. It's better described as the principle of non-discrimination. And the precept is very simple. All trade, regardless of source, will be treated equally. It may be that this norm is still applied to the majority of international trade, but it's not the direction in which government policies are trending. More emphasis at present is on concluding trade agreements on a bilateral or regional basis. Seems easier. This is true of all the major countries and all the middle countries, really. The United States, China, the European Union, are all working very hard on bilateral agreements. For the United States, while making proposals for improving the WTO, because the U.S. is still very actively engaged in the WTO, it's also actively engaged in seeking a bilateral agreement with Japan and with greater difficulty with the European Union. The EU, for its part, has spent enormous energy over the last two decades in trying to obtain and succeeding in obtaining close to 100 bilateral agreements. China is actively pursuing One Belt, One Road, which is not claimed by China to be a global scheme. It's a scheme between China and individual countries. It deepens economic relationships for Beijing with a wide range of countries individually. The developing countries in their statements in general aspire to what they would consider equal treatment through catching up through better than equal treatment. The last successful attempt at an across-the-board multilateral solution was the creation of the WTO itself, which began in 1995. It came into being in 1995, an accomplishment that belongs to a prior generation. The broad multilateral attempts that followed, launched in 2001 and thereafter, failed to be concluded, and there is no consensus to make further attempts. Douglas Irwin has written a very good book and has an excellent discussion of the origins of modern trade policy and the objectives that were to be ingrained as rules of the new multilateral trading system. This was a lot of it was planning in Washington during the war, during the Second World War. In 1943, U.S. planners held a belief that, and I quote, a great expansion in the value of international trade after the war will be essential to the fulfillment of full employment in the United States and elsewhere, to the preservation of private enterprise, and to the success of an international security system to prevent future wars. it's important to recognize that the original idea of the post-war planners was, having gone through the 1930s, having seen the mistakes that were made, was to create a world that had more stability, more economic growth, and an ability to avoid another conflagration, such as World War II was, and World War I had been. A central blueprint for the post-war era by the U.S. Interagency Planning Committee called for, I quote, the elimination of all forms of discriminatory treatment in international trade. The U.S. had been on the receiving end of discrimination from the U.K.'s system of imperial preferences. The U.S. very much wanted to get rid of preferential trade. The expansion of trade on a non-discriminatory basis was to be accompanied by the elimination of rigid control by governments, by the state, the elimination of subsidies on exports and domestically. The decline in the practice of non-discrimination is most worrying because it's not confined to any limited set of measures and arrangements. It's going to take a long time to repair. That said, my belief is the restoration of non-discrimination as the centerpiece of the world trading system is highly likely, but it's going to take some time. The entire striving of humanity has been towards less discrimination. You see it at home, in domestic rules, in lack of discrimination, less discrimination. It could be on the basis of gender or sex, sexual proclivities, on any other basis, ethnicity, anything at all. That is the progress, the direction in which I believe humanity is tending, and it will be and is the direction that ultimately international trade will take. Trade will once again be aligned with what the founders were trying to achieve. Sub-multinational arrangements will be superseded, in my view, over time, by worldwide rules. The chief exception will occur in the case of nations that are working on a single market, the way the Europeans have, the way the United States did, regional integration, the way the Africans are now starting to seek through the African Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement. So that's my vision of where things are headed. It's going to take a while, and we'll go through what might be called a bad patch on the way to getting to that outcome. So what are our problems? What's the problem with the WTO? It's not what you read in the headlines, in my view. It has been a failure to legislate, a failure to have the ability to legislate, meaning set new rules. It's the greatest challenge. It doesn't grab any headlines. Why does it exist? We have 164 members. They're sovereign countries. They have their own interests. And our rule is consensus. So in order to get anything done, if you look at consensus as unanimity, all must agree. So in effect, you have, in terms of your sovereignty, the sovereignty of 164, yourself, one country, because you can block something from happening. One country raises its hand and says, I don't want this agenda adopted at this particular meeting, and it is not adopted. So there is an issue with the fact that rulemaking is very difficult to take place. Since 1995, we've had three agreements of any size. One is the Trade Facilitation Agreement, which is to lower barriers at the border, not in terms of the level of a tariff, but simply how do you get something from one country into the next country? Do you have information that allows you to move something across a border? The second was the expansion of the Information Technology Agreement, And the third was a ban on agricultural export subsidies. Not insignificant achievements, but nothing in the last 5 years has been achieved in terms of an agreement. Matters that should have been ripe for negotiation no longer are. There was a negotiation underway for duty-free treatment for environmental goods. It hasn't been mentioned since I've been at the WTO, not because I'm there, but in the last 2 years, not a mention, nothing. There was to be a review of the coverage of the information technology agreement under its terms in 2018. Hasn't been mentioned. This is not a time of trade liberalization. Countries do not have a feeling of political support for opening their borders in that sense. The one thing that all countries have committed to in the WTO, all members, all 164, is to have fishery subsidies disciplined by the end of this year. It's been 20 years that this has been underway. It's a goal of the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations. What does it mean? It's more than an environmental issue. It's more than the fact that schools of fish are being taken out of the ocean by large factory ships that are heavily subsidized. It is depriving coastal nations in poor countries. This is a south-south issue. It's not a north-south issue. The Somali fishermen, instead of being fishers of fish, became fishers of tankers. Piracy. And therefore, it's the only place in the planet, I think, where there are six countries with military operations in Djibouti, including China, all designed to counter piracy. Why does the piracy exist? The fish have been taken away. Trade conflicts. The headlines mostly concern current trade confrontations, often seen as a failure of the WTO. No international agreement has ever prevented a conflict if a country or two decide to have a conflict. There were three, at least, major treaties after the First World War. The Versailles Treaty, the Treaty of Locarno, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, all said, we're not going to have war anymore. That lasted for, 15, 20 years maximum, before there was war again. Treaties are not enough to prevent conflict. The WTO is not designed to prevent conflict of that nature. It's designed to settle disputes that are more manageable, such as Boeing Airbus, 15 years of litigation. Rise of a new economic power, my experience, and some of you perhaps in this room, was with the rise of Japan. There was a lot of what we used to call trade friction. It took 30 years to work out a modus vivendi with Japan, with the rest of the world, to avoid trade friction. It's a time-consuming, difficult process of a major rising economic power. And of course, we now have the rise of China. It's not just rivalry that is born of competition, it's differing economic organizations. And it heightens the level of friction or conflict. An unanswered question that some academics have raised is, what's the WTO about? Is it about coexistence or is it about convergence? And that goes not just for the West and the relationship to China with more than slightly different economic organizations. It's about what is the end result supposed to be with developing countries and the developed? Is it about just coexistence where the developing countries never quite develop? Or is it about convergence, where the developing countries do develop? The resolution of a trade conflict has to rest primarily with the parties involved. The WTO is not going to settle the issue. There's no one to call up Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi and say, we have an idea how to cure this thing. They're going to have to work it out. The good news is that if they come up with some issues of principles, means of dealing with each other, which have general applicability, if they came up with an idea of how to manage industrial subsidies, if they came up with an idea on how to manage the involvement in international trade of state-owned or state-influenced or state-controlled enterprises, that can be generalized. It can be brought into the WTO as a rule. Another area of friction, quite obviously, that is challenging, is there are issues that members consider non-justiciable, meaning if a country says, in our national security, we have to restrict something, steel, aluminum, for example, they're not going to take lightly to someone telling them they can't do that. And it's a problem. In some instances, WTO dispute settlement will find a solution. We'll see. Much in the news is whether the type of dispute settlement mechanism that the WTO has, because after all, this is an agreement that is enforceable, which is different from most other agreements. A country does something, the United States adopts a tax measure, or the Chinese do, or someone else does. It's found to be inconsistent with the rules, and generally speaking, they repeal the measure. That's what China did in 2004 when it had a discriminatory rebate of value-added taxes on semiconductors. It's what the U.S. did earlier, when it had tax measures that were considered contrary to the system. When I said that consensus is an issue, in order to get something done, you need consensus. In order to make a rule, you need consensus. Exactly the reverse takes place when you get a decision of the dispute of a dispute by the panels or the appellate body. It goes to a committee of the whole, and you have to have unanimity to avoid adoption of that decision and it becoming final. And you think about that. The loser has to agree, along with the winner, that the decision in favor of the winner will not be adopted. That never happens. It's simply a non-existent set of circumstances. The winner is not going to say, we litigated, and by the way, that's okay, don't adopt the report. Not going to happen. So along comes the United States, and it says, for 15 or 20 years, we've been complaining that the appellate body has overstepped its bounds. It has narrowed the ability of us in the United States, I can't say us, them, I'm an international civil servant, would be inappropriate for me to be an American in this circumstance. But the American point of view is, we agreed we'd liberalize trade generally, but within bounds that we have agreed, we will be able to take care of injured industries to some degree for some time. And the appellate body has said, actually, not in this instance, but it said that repeatedly. And from a U.S. perspective, it has said that in a way that was never agreed. The European view, the EU view, is this is a court, and it makes decisions, and you should know that it would evolve law. But if you had no legislature in Australia, and you just had courts, and the courts said, well, we've never seen this kind of situation before, But we find the following, and there was no ability to change that result because there was no legislature that would cause a problem. In the WTO, there is no rulemaking capability as a general proposition, there are exceptions, and I'll get to that. But what happens on December 10th? There are supposed to be 7 appellate body members. There are now 3. The terms of 2 expire on December 10th, leaving 1. It takes 3 to make a decision at the appellate level. And that means no new cases can be filed. So what could happen? You could have country A says, we won at the panel level. Country B says, we're going to appeal. Country A says, you know there's no appeal. There is no appellate body that can hear this case. Country B says, who did that? You did it. Country A says, well, if you don't change your, if you don't comply with the ruling of the panel, we're going to retaliate. Country B says, if you retaliate, we'll counter-retaliate. That's if there's anything left to retaliate on between these two hypothetical countries that retaliate against each other. Is that what's going to happen? I don't think so. That would be Armageddon. Every dispute ends up in retaliation and counter-retaliation. Instead, Indonesia and Vietnam have already said, we have a dispute, and if there is no appellate body, we'll abide by the panel decision. We won't appeal. The EU, the European Union, and Canada have said, we're going to call back past appellate body members, and they'll be arbitrators, and we agree among ourselves that if we need to appeal, we'll appeal to those past members of the appellate body, and whatever they say, we'll abide by. So there will be pragmatic ways of dealing with this. Is it an optimal solution? No, because what you want out of an appellate system is some consistency of rulings, not just ad hoc. You get 3 people to come up with a review, and you want to be able to correct egregious errors. And you want both consistency and the ability to correct errors. So there should be an appellate process. Can there be? I believe so. The ambassador of New Zealand to the WTO, David Walker, who was the chief TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiator for New Zealand, has been working to find a consensus for way through all of this and come up with some answers, and we may get there. To me, if countries could agree, members could agree, in 1995 as to how to handle disputes, they can do it actually in 2019, more likely 2020. So no apocalypse yet. I don't see it coming. Third element, the future governance of world trade. I don't see the multilateral trade system as in a period of decline. I see some challenges, which I've mentioned. Challenges like less adherence to international agreements. Challenges in that the WTO dispute settlement system is in disrepair. Challenges in the fact that countries are spending a heck of a lot more time and energy on bilateral arrangements rather than multilateral, because it's an easier route to progress. But the question is a preferential agreement, which is what they are, good for the world, for the non-parties, for all the non-parties? Is it trade-creating? The whole idea of a preferential trading agreement initially was, which I think NAFTA would qualify, I think that when there was an EU-EFTA, that certainly qualifies. There are a number of agreements that one could say, that's probably trade-creating. Long-distance free trade agreements, in my view, should raise a question mark. when the United States enters into an agreement with Korea, is that good for the rest of the world or not? WTO doesn't look at that. No analysis is provided. I asked the Europeans, you just announced an agreement with Mercosur. That's nice. Is that good for the world? On your website, you claim benefits for the European producers. Do you say anything about how it's better for the world that you did this? And they said they didn't address that. Well, somebody ought to address that. So if this is not being looked at, but the G20, the most important economies in the world, have called for reform of the WTO, why not look at whether preferential agreements are good for the world in general, trade creating more than trade diverting, or not? There are trade policy reviews in the WTO. Every country goes through a review, and there's a committee meeting, and members like this come in representing all the different countries, and they express opinions, and the result is, for major countries, zero. They don't change anything they're doing. Shouldn't there be some analysis? For example, could easily get into some degree of difficulty. The U.S. has had sugar protection since colonial times. Is that good for the U.S.? What are the costs? How does it affect income distribution? Is it good for the workers in the sugar industry? Is it good for exporters of sugar? When there's a preferential agreement with Mexico that calls for a certain amount of sugar coming into the United States, is that good for the world? Is it good for others who are producing sugar? It's an interesting question. Why not examine it? So we're not doing that, and it's just not one of the subjects for reform. Where do we end up? World trade needs a single set of rules with allowances made for differences in levels of capability, obviously. I think the peoples of the world have tasted non-discrimination and they're not going to go back all the way to just discriminating. Domestic policies are required to assure that income distribution, income inequality, is dealt with. That's not something that is easy to do or the purpose of the World Trade Organization, but we can help in that. If you have, in any country of the world, a laptop, access to a computer, and you have an idea, you can sell it today, pretty much, any place in the world, because there is no intervention by a government to stop you from doing it. Some countries say, well, wait a minute, we've had a moratorium on customs duties on electronic transmissions. It was agreed to 20 years ago. No one knew what that meant at the time. The internet was, if any place at all, in its infancy. Developing countries are saying now, we're losing tariff revenues. We used to import DVDs, we put a 10% tariff on it, now there's streaming, we don't get to put the tariff on it, we're losing revenues. That might be okay in limited circumstances to think about, and I don't speak for any country whether they'd think it's okay or not, but what happens if you say, we're designing a port, and we got a foreign contractor to give us the plans, to give us the engineering, and that was a $100 million contract. What if you put a 30% tariff on that? That wouldn't actually be a very positive development for world trade. So the e-commerce negotiation, which is being led by Australia, with the active help of Japan and Singapore and others, is extraordinarily important. The good news is that the members of the WTO are trying very hard to make the world a better place. They are working on facilitating investment, an agreement to facilitate investment. They're working on an agreement to facilitate the reduction of barriers to domestic regulation of services. They're working on seeing that where can trade be more gender neutral, be actually more helpful, particularly to women. How can that occur? And they're looking for ways to make that happen. How can small and medium enterprises have a better shot at trade? My daughter-in-law had a toy business. She designed shadow puppets, not that looked like Indonesian shadow puppets, but they were different types of shadow puppets. And she wasn't going to create a platform on the web to design those things. The platforms existed. She was not going to create the materials to make the puppets. The sticks and the alligator clips and the plastic that needed to be used, you go on the web and you find those things. World, that means one person sitting at home with a laptop can earn an income. That's going to help both gender equality to some degree, because more women are in the caregiving side of things and don't and need the flexibility of time. And they also they need tools that are readily available on the web. So we're entering a new era, and we've got to keep governments from getting in the way with excessive regulation. By the way, the U.S. government managed to kill off that business because the U.S. would say in its wisdom, those alligator clips you bought on the web, are there any conflict minerals in them? Well, who knows? So that was a domestic issue. What I'm saying is we're headed towards a better place. We're going to go through a rough patch. By that I mean that we don't know if Xi Jinping and Donald Trump will settle things with on even an interim basis tomorrow. They could. We just don't know that. We can't control it. We're not going to have instant trade liberalization, but we could have new rules that will help facilitate the flow of trade. So that's my story. I am very optimistic because I think that we're going to get in the right direction. We have the Australian government. We have the New Zealand government. We have others. Nigeria and Benin are in the e-commerce negotiations. Some Latin Americans are certainly there. Brazil is very forward-looking with respect to agricultural trade. They will have proposals on the table. The world is changing in a better direction. It's not in the headlines, but it's coming. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. It was very nice, actually, and surprising to end on such optimism when it comes to world trade, given, as you note, where all the headlines are at the moment. So what we'll do now is we'll, of course, open it up to the floor for questions. We have roving mics, so if you have a question, put your hand up. Please identify yourself and any affiliation, and also wait for the mic, and, of course, stick to questions rather than comments. Just to maybe kick things off, I mean, and please get ready with your questions in the meantime. I mean, one of the big issues is around the so-called special and differentiated treatment, right, and the role or the status of developing countries. You've got China claiming developing country status, India, but you've also got, say, Singapore, right? So this is obviously a very highly contentious issue. It's one of the reasons why the WTO hasn't been able to move forward with new rulemaking. So what are your thoughts there? Like, how can that should be resolved? What are the pathways to moving forward? Is there optimism there as well?
Absolutely. Singapore says, yes, we have per capita GDP, level of income of our people by individual, higher than that of Great Britain, which gap may increase shortly. But we're an island. and for a variety of reasons, we want to say we're a developing country, but they don't say, if we enter into a new agreement, we're really going to demand better treatment than the rest of you people who didn't, the minority, who didn't claim developing country status. 120 out of 164 say we're developing countries. No one is going to give China, let's say, more favorable treatment on, let's say there were an agreement on artificial intelligence or space exploration. They'd say, wait a minute, it seems that you just put a person on the moon or other things on the moon. It seems that you're an absolute leader, and the Chinese are now going to demand it. But they are adamant that they are a developing country, and they look at, so does India, on per capita GDP. They got a lot of people. You divide the GDP, the total value of the economy, by the number of people, and you come up with a small number. They say, with fairness, that 200 million people are below the poverty level on small holdings in agriculture. It's true. I suspect. That doesn't mean that in an agreement on something else, they are going to be given so-called special and differential treatment, which means what it sounds like to American ears is we want something. Before we enter into any agreement, we want you to agree that we're going to get a better deal than you get. And that is actually contrary to the founding concept of the multilateral trading system, which is equal trade. What everybody knew that if you're in difficulty, you get treatment that is consistent with your degree of development. I'll just give you one example. One reason I'm optimistic, two things, is one, I chair the Consultative Forum on Development Assistance for Cotton. The beneficiaries of four West African countries, primarily, Mali, Benin, Burkina Faso, and Chad, they're very, very poor. They do not produce cotton very efficiently. They're at 10% the level of efficiency. Australia is the most efficient. U.S. is half the level of efficiency of, I'm told, of Australia. And it's not just mechanization. It is, if anything, mostly culture of how you grow things, what kind of plants you want to use. The rest of the world meets in a room like this, and India, Pakistan, Germany, Denmark, the United States, the European Union all say, how can we help you? Can we help you make cotton seeds, take the poison out of them so it can be a food for animals and people? Can we help you make cotton seed oil? Can we help you take the rest of the plant and make it into fiber board so you can use it for construction? There is no contentiousness in that room. And the four developing countries don't come into the room and say, we want policy space, which means don't expect us to undertake any obligations with respect to putting on trade restrictions in the future. They say, let's have some practical help. So I think the differentiation in the future is not going to be between with advances in technology, it's not going to be the difference between I'm a developing country, so just give me everything because I said so, you give me special treatment. It's going to be tailored to how can we help you develop in a real way, and that's worth doing. And that is not the position of many countries today.
Mm. So it sounds like it's a little bit harder.
I'm now in trouble with the developing countries. I've only been criticized by the United States, China, and Europe so far. Now I've added the developing world, but so be it.
All So we're trying to do here with the public.
We're trying to actually take care of the rest of my time in Geneva.
Okay, do we have any questions from the floor? Yes, gentleman at the front here, please.
Thank you, Alan. My name's Freddie Sharp. I admire your optimism. I'm not sure I share it, that political chaos will sometime soon give way to pragmatism and a new equilibrium, but let's hope so. My question is whether there's a larger existential threat to world trade, which you touched on once or twice, for example, the overfishing of the seas and the resource constraints. I think we're seeing everywhere around the world now an emerging awareness that resources are finite and infinite growth is unsustainable. And countries, I think, are making moves now to secure their own resources and make sure they can acquire resources from other states, which inevitably, I think, would lead to away from global trade, more to isolation and aggressive acquisition. Is that a trend you see? And how will we begin to address that through such organs as the WTO?
No, what I see is I gave a talk in Adelaide at the Trade Institute. They want to know what's the future of world trade structure look like. And since looking at 2020 is not all that helpful, I simply said, let's look at 2050 and then think about how we get there. There are going to be two billion more people in the world. They have to be fed. Climate change is causing changes in crop yields here and there. Food has to move from surplus areas to deficit areas. Therefore, freer trade in agriculture is going to be forced. It's not going to be something that someone embraces because they think that it's just a great idea. It's going to be essential. There's a young lady in Sweden, Greta Thunberg, I think her name was, who said, I'm going to have a strike. I'm not going to school on Wednesdays or whatever it was, because the stuff in my cafeteria is non-biodegradable that they're serving my food on. And it caught on worldwide amongst kids. And the net result was businesses said demand is spiking for biodegradable plates and forks and spoons. It is consumer demand is going to push things along. So I think physical need is going to be one driving force. New Zealand is working on a declaration against fossil fuel subsidies. I mean, it's one thing to rely on fossil fuels excessively, but do you have to also subsidize them? It's an interesting question. Sooner or later, that may catch on. I think reality intrudes and drives folks in the right direction. Too late, or very late, but ultimately, we end up in the right place to introduce a negative note. 2 weeks ago, with better weather than this, I was in the Dordogne on vacation and visited the museum, which is now the Lascaux Cave. And it turns out that 28,000 years ago, those who made the cave paintings understood perspective. And they could indicate motion by having the same way kids would draw on a pad of paper, the progression of movement. It just got lost for about 25,000 years, or until the Renaissance came along, until the painters in Holland said, I can make a church look like it has depth, and started painting that way. I don't think we're going to have a 28,000 year gap. I think we're going to learn a few things and get some things right. And it may not be next year, and it may not be 5 years from now, but we're going to get things right. Also, artificial intelligence means will know a lot more facts about a lot of things, so that right now we don't have the best information on trade measures. There will be a time not long from now where they'll all be known. Not only will they be known, but you could say, oh, if I set a tariff 10% higher, what will the effect be on downstream industries? What will the effect be on whether it's likely, if you can play Go and you can play chess on a machine, you can also take it and apply it to trade and say, if I apply protection to something, is my country going to be better off? You know, if you, one economist said, my father had protection for ballpoint pens and he developed a wonderful business in Turkey. Well, how many teachers earned less money because pens were more expensive? How many schools were less able to buy sporting goods or books because pens were more expensive? Did the pen industry become competitive in Turkey? Do we all buy Turkish ballpoint pens today? You'll be able to press a button, actually, and within a millisecond, like you get an answer on Google, it'll say, yeah, this is what happens. You're screwed as a country, using a technical term. We'll know a lot more. And there'll still be a political element. So trade negotiations will be much better informed, but you still have to say, oh, yeah, but if I do that, that guy won't vote for my tax bill. So there'll always be a human element, but we'll know more. And we may get a little smarter.
Coming back to your optimism, which I admire, why would your optimism must be assuming that there won't be a continued atrophy in global trading rules. But why would that? Why, if in an environment of low trend economic growth and rising inequalities in a large number of countries, isn't an atrophy of global trending rules an inevitable outcome of those situations? In other words, until you change the low economic growth pace and somehow address the inequalities, this is just an outcome. Your optimism is obviously arguing against that, and I wonder if you could elaborate on why that's...
In the United States, men over the age of, largely white men, over the age of 55 are anti-trade. They lost their jobs in factories, largely to technology, but that... Trade, you can't blame technology because no one says, oh, I'm giving up my flat screen TV, I'm giving up my iPhone or whatever, my smartphone. Instead, they say trade was just terrible. That is not the view of the young, at least in the United States. And one person who was in charge of polling said, there's a solution. The old men have to die. And some smart person from an audience said, well, what if the young, as they grow old, become more protectionist? And my response was, then we who have died will be very disappointed. No, I think we're headed towards, why I say a rough patch? Artificial intelligence is going to displace potentially 3 million truck drivers in the United States. They're not going to feel very good about things. And domestic policies have to be responsive. It will not be possible to blame that on trade. There's not going to be an influx of foreign trucks that put them out of their job. It's going to be the technology. And they have to find something else. And that's the responsibility of each government to work out, and not the WTO.
Thank you. Jim Wilson from FreightWaves. We're a specialist freight, trade, and logistics publication. We have about 20 million readers in the US. What are the likely effects on world trade given the ongoing consolidation of ocean shipping companies and freight forwarders? If that gets down to a mere handful of companies, can competition law exemptions ever be justified in such a scenario?
Grab the other one as well.
Jeff Miller from the Institute of International Affairs. A somewhat political question. In the current row between the US and Iran, the Iranian government repeatedly refers to US economic sanctions against Iran as illegal. Does that make sense in terms of the WTO, and is that a meaningful thing to say in regard to the workings of the WTO?
I think competition law eventually has to come into the WTO. It's not there now, and in fact, it is why the International Trade Organization was never ratified by the Congress in the late 40s, early 50s. Business was afraid of some international organization getting involved in competition policy, is what I've read. Clearly competition policy is one of the elements of whether trade can flow. Our problems with Japan and the U.S. and other folks had problems with Japan was that competition policy during a particular period for favored industries was anti-competitive, not pro-competitive. It was anti-consumer. In the U.S., competition, and I suspect here, competition policy is about helping the consumer by having competition. In Japan in that era, for steel, for example, competition was dampened by the competition authority. So I do think ultimately you do need competition. Competition, however, can come from new technologies. I haven't read up enough about it, but my understanding is that there will be advances. Just like, you know, what has been the greatest thing that has promoted free trade? You could say, oh, rule of law, it's been wonderful. Freighters that have container ships, super container ships, move things very cheaply. That was a major advance. There will be other advances somehow that are more energy efficient even than that. We just haven't seen them yet, but they'll come along. 3D printing is coming along as an alternative to shipping. So there's the technological aspect, but there's also a bringing competition law in. Article 21 never, for 40 years, was not litigated in the WTO. Article 21 is national security exemption. The U.S. had restrictions on companies dealing with Cuba in the 1980s. And the EU was very offended by that, and they worked out a deal. And they didn't litigate it because countries generally do not want to be told by an international body what's in their national security interest. Steel cases are coming along. Aluminum cases are coming along. They will be litigated. We'll see how that turns out and how well they're received, whatever the answer is. There was one case that has gone through dispute settlement and on national security, and that is Ukraine and Russia. And the panel said, yeah, there's a war. And as part of a war, for national security reasons, as I understand the case, you could put on restrictions as a matter of national security. So it's a very sensitive area for a panel of three individuals to say, we know what's in your national security. But could there be extreme cases of the Swedes said for national security reasons, this was decades ago, we're going to restrict imports of boots. Why? An army has to march on boots. So for national security, we need to have a domestic boot industry. Well, of course they didn't. And the laughter caused them to change their rule. They weren't condemned by a panel. They were condemned by just the mirth that their proposal caused. It's a sensitive area. One dead area of the WTO is currency manipulation. There's a rule that you shall not use currency exchange rate changes policy to frustrate the benefits of trade actions. Ministers of finance don't want trade people involved in this action at all, and it's never been invoked. So there are areas of international relations that are very, very sensitive to somebody. Competition policy, there is no competition authority that is, that I know of, that's pressing a trade minister to get into his or her business. But should there be an aspect of competition policy that's looked at? I would think so. It's not on the table currently, but at some point it will be. I think, again, it was once, and it will be again.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. But thank you, Alan, for, you know, very wide-ranging and also very optimistic comments. I'm not sure everyone necessarily shares all of that optimism, but it's good to hear that there is optimism at the WTO. So would everyone just please just join me in thanking Alan for his talk.